Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's November 26th. If we look at the schedule, we see that we should cover the respiratory system, and indeed we are. We started that last time. We'll finish that up today. And when is your next test? December 10th. Where is that compared to today? So today is the 26th. So it's exactly 2 weeks away from today, right? And it just so happens that people that have lab on Wednesday, this is your last lab of the semester. You only get to do 13 labs, and this is it. The Monday group, next week will be your last lab. And next week for the Wednesday group, you get an extra week to review things. That's a review period. And all these chapters will be on the last test, which is going to be on a Wednesday, so the Wednesday labs will have a practicum and the lecture exam on the same day. So one lab before, one lab after. The Monday group, Monday labs get a practicum on Monday and then their lecture exam on Wednesday. The Monday class will also have to take a lab quiz after the practicum, but the Wednesday class will take their last quiz next week. So they don't have to take it after the practicum. All right, so that's all how that works. Anybody have a question about schedule? No? Yeah, you can see me, email me anytime. Anyway, do we have any announcements from SI? Anything from SI? Anybody know anything special? What's going on? Probably not. Okay. What about questions from last time? Remember we started the, respiratory system. All right, so we just talked about the passageways, like the trachea is held open all the time. Why is the trachea open all the time? That seems like you're asking for trouble if you keep something open all the time. Why is the trachea held open all the time? What holds it open all the time? Cartilage. I heard cartilage. I like that. Let's see if I can find the hat. Can you see the screen okay with that one light on? Or should I turn it off? Okay, I'll leave it on, because I want to draw on the board probably today just a little bit. Oh, that's not what I want to do. Yeah, this is what I want to do. Okay, so it's held open all the time by cartilages, those C-shaped cartilages, and it's open all the time because if it was just a muscular tube, when we tried to exhale, we compress our thoracic cavity. When we exhale, that compression will also close off that air passageway, the trachea. But the trachea is strong enough to remain open because it has the cartilage rings on it. Okay. So how are you guys doing back there? Okay. All right, so let's all listen to lecture. We want to finish this class, all right? So let's help each other out. So here is the trachea. You can see the cartilaginous rings, this first bifurcation, then the trachea becomes a bronchus, and there's a right and left main bronchus, and then after another bifurcation, then this is a secondary bronchus, and then that bifurcates again, so this would be tertiary, on and on down the line, right? Okay, and can you tell from here which if the lungs are the same size, or are they different size? They're a different size. Yeah, which one is smaller? The one on the left. Why do you think the one on the left is smaller? Oh, you're right, because the heart is in there. I forgot about that. The heart is in that same location, so the lung has to be smaller. And indeed, I do see a little notch over here on the left side, right? And that's exactly where the heart sits. It's just right in here. Sometimes we even call that the cardiac notch in the lung. Okay, and I see that the right lung has three lobes, the left lung only has two. Because of that, right? And so you know how these things are named. Okay, if we continue through these air passageways, right, we get the smaller and smaller and smaller tubes. And finally, we get to, let's see if I have this in your lecture notes. I'm sure I do. Yep, indeed I do. Okay. We get down to a bronchiole. And when we look at a bronchiole, this is a really small tube. Do you see any cartilage on this bronchiole? Do you see cartilage? No cartilage, that's right. I see people shaking their heads. All right, but what do you see? you see smooth muscle, right? So here's some smooth muscle wrapped around. So the diameter of these tubes can be adjusted. They can be constricted or they can become dilated because of the smooth muscle. That helps regulate where air goes inside the lungs. All right. Well, after this terminal bronchial, it even goes into a smaller tube that we call respiratory bronchioles. I see a respiratory bronchiole here and here. And on this bronchiole, and indeed there's no cartilage here, just smooth muscle, so it, in a sense it's like a terminal bronchiole, just smaller. But I see this little sac or berry, right? This is what we call an alveolus. So there is air inside this alveolus. So a respiratory bronchiole is still a bronchiole because it has smooth muscle, but it has some alveoli attached to them, and the alveoli is important for gas exchange. And that's one of the functions of the respiratory system, is to exchange oxygen that's in the air, bring it into the body. So the air inside this alveolus brings oxygen into the body. So here's a respiratory bronchiole. It's connected to even something smaller. We call this an alveolar duct, and you can see that there are alveoli even attached to this, some more. And then finally, you just get to this big group of alveoli, right? And there's not a bronchiole between them, but there are pores. There are alveolar pores, which air can flow through. All right, so let's take a look at those alveoli. All right, that's the site for exchange. Okay, how many of these do we have in our body? I don't have it in the notes. Well, between 100 million and 300 million alveoli in a lung. So you might be wondering, why do we have so many? Why isn't the lung just one big sac? So here you can see the alveolar pores. Right here is the alveolar duct. I can see some other structures around the alveolus, like these gold things right here. Those are elastic fibers. What can you tell me about an elastic fiber? If you stretch them, you can't stretch them without damaging them. So that's number one. What's number two? When you let go, they recoil. They go back to their original length. Because these alveoli inflate and then deflate. Inflate, they get big and small every time we take a breath. All right, so those elastic fibers are really important. All right, so here is a really nice representation of a group of alveoli. And we can see here's a group with elastic fibers, right? But what is missing are some vascular units. What kind of blood vessel do we need for exchange? A capillary, right? And then over here, I see capillaries. See this nice capillary network that surrounds every alveolus? That's where gas exchange takes place. But don't forget, there's also going to be elastic fibers around each of these alveoli. And it's really important to know that, let me see if I talk about this later on, I talk about it a little bit later on, but don't forget about these elastic fibers, right? So once you inhale, what do these elastic fibers do? They help you exhale. Yeah, so when you breathe in, they stretch, and when you relax, they go back to their original length. That helps expel air from the lungs. All right, you also have some white blood cells that operate in these spaces looking for infectious agents like bacteria and viruses, and then they'll try to come up with some kind of immune response to kill those bacteria, deal with those viruses. So that's pretty important. Okay, so why do we have all of these alveoli right there? About 300 million of them. Why do we have all these things? How come not just one big sac? Well, if we were to take one of these alveoli and flatten it out, think of it like being an orange, and you take the skin off of an orange and put it down on a table, right, you could measure the surface area of that skin, okay? And if you were to take all 300 million of those alveoli and flatten it out on the table, how big would this table have to be? If we were to take all 300 million of those, put them all next to each other, all flat, so that the membrane was nice and continuous all the way around. I've forgotten. I hope it's in my notes here. Okay. Oh yeah, 300 million, here we go, gas exchange, 300 million alveoli, and if we flatten them all out, that's going to be 70 square meters, and that's equal to one half of a tennis court. All right, so if we didn't, if these alveoli weren't all packaged inside your thoracic cavity, right, that membrane for exchange would have to be as wide as a tennis court and half as long. So is that huge? Anybody know what a tennis court kind of looks like? Everybody kind of know what a tennis court? That's a big area, right? And personally, I would not elect to have to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall as one, right? So how does nature figure out to put a big, huge membrane like that into a small space? So let's pretend that this is half of a tennis court right here. How would you put that surface area, that small, okay, that large surface area into a small space? What would you do to this piece of paper? Yeah, fold it up, right? So I'm just going to kind of fold it up. And I just crumpled it up because I don't want to take time. And so now we have, right, is it the same surface area? Is the piece of paper the same size? Is the piece of paper the same size as before? Yep, exactly the same size. So the surface area is exactly the same. But what about the space that it takes up? Much smaller, right? So this fits inside the thoracic cavity. That big piece of paper, right, that half a tennis court would not fit inside our thoracic cavity. All right, so when we say surface area, what the heck do we mean by that, a surface area? It is just the length of something times the height that tells us how much surface area is in that particular square. And so I want to measure. Here I have a meter. This is 1 meter. So I want to measure the surface of something. All right, this table's pretty good, but, oh, let's do it up this door. Yeah, come on in. All right, so how would we calculate the surface area of this door? Measure the width, and then measure the height, multiply those two numbers together, and that would tell us, since we're measuring it in meters, how many square meters, right? A distance is a meter, an area will be square meters, a volume would be cubic meters. But so we want to do square meters. So how wide is this door? Oh, wow, look at that. It just so happens it's exactly 1 meter long, right? 1 meter wide. That's really handy because, right, multiplying anything by one is really easy, right? So it's 1 meter. Now we got to measure how tall it is to figure out what the surface area is. So what is the height of this? It's 1 meter. Okay, I'll keep my thumb there. And is it, oh, it's exactly 2 meters. That's nice. So what's the square area of this door right here? 2 square meters, right? So when I talk about surface area, I want you to think about it in a certain way, in a layman's way. How would you want to think of surface area as a, what's that right there? A doorway. And what is a doorway used for? It's used for exchange. Okay? So when somebody says surface area, think of exchange. Think of a doorway for exchange between two different compartments. Okay? But then we also want to know what happens to exchange if we change the size of a doorway. How many people can we get through that doorway at one time? 2, 3 people, get a running start, 4? Nah, probably not ever 4. All right, so 2 people, 3 people. Now let's take this doorway, this pedestrian door, and compare it to the garage door that you might be familiar with. We open up the garage door, right, a car can drive in and out. How many people can get through that doorway at one time? Like 3, 4? No, you're shaking your head. No, what am I thinking? No, it's going to be like 20, 30, maybe 40 people at one time, right? So as the doorway gets bigger, what can you tell me about exchange? It gets larger as well, right? So the surface area of that doorway is proportional to the exchange across that doorway. And so what's the size of that doorway in a lung? It is 70 square of these things. And that's equal to half of a tennis court. So that's a huge doorway. I don't know how many people could get through that doorway at one time, but hundreds probably if they tried. Okay. So when I say surface area for exchange, you should think of automatically a door, right? A doorway, a passageway for something. Okay. Let me see what the next couple of slides are. All right, let's zoom into an alveolus. So here is one of these alveoli. and I see a layer, right? And it looks like an epithelium to me. And indeed it is, because what does an epithelium do? It lines a cavity or covers a surface. That's what we've always said. So here is that lining of the alveolus. And now you should be able to tell me what kind of epithelium is that? What kind of epithelium do we see? It is, I heard it, it is simple squamous, right? It's just one cell layer thick, and these are pancake-shaped cells, so it's a squamous. So we completely characterize that epithelium. And that epithelium is specialized for what kind of purpose? It's specialized for exchange, right? Exchange, because it's so thin, it's easier for things to move across that membrane. Right, and here is a blood vessel, here is a capillary, and what is a capillary specialized for? Exchange, once again, and if we look at that endothelium, the lining of a capillary, we're going to see that it's a simple squamous epithelium as well. We call that an endothelium. All right, so air has to move. Oh, let's zoom into this area. Let's zoom into this area right here where I see some air in the alveolus. All right, I see the wall of the alveolus, and oh, I see a capillary with some blood, red blood cells in the capillary, and let's come over here. All right, so here's air in the alveolus that's going to be high in oxygen. This blood is going to be relatively low because this is coming back from our body, and our body takes that oxygen out so that it can make ATP. Right, and so here the blood contains a lot of CO2, but the concentration of CO2 in the air is very close to zero. And the process of diffusion, molecules will always move from high to low concentration. That's diffusion. So that means oxygen is going to move into the blood because that's the concentration gradient. CO2 will move out from the blood into the alveolus, right? Because that's the concentration gradient, and that's all done by diffusion, right? And can anybody remember, does diffusion take energy, or does it just happen automatically? It's automatically. Yeah, so this gas exchange right here in the lung happens automatically. All right, but we need that huge doorway to supply oxygen to our body, and that's a huge doorway. So we talk about this membrane right here as being the respiratory membrane because that's the thing that these molecules have to go across. So the respiratory membrane, I have it a little bit different in your notes. Right, then it is in the book. Right, let me find it here in your notes. It's in here someplace. Okay, you guys can look for that as I maybe talk about it. All right, your book calls the respiratory membrane, or defines it to be the wall of the alveolus, a little interstitial space or basement membrane, and the wall of the capillary. So that's the membrane that these gases have to move across. I'd like to modify that a little bit by including some fluid that's on the surface of the alveolus. Right, so I like to consider the respiratory membrane the wall of the capillary, this basement membrane, the wall of the alveolus, and the fluid, the name of that fluid that's right on the surface of the alveolus, we call that surfactant. Surfactant. And surfactant just stands for surface active agent. And we got to figure out what the purpose of that surface active agent is. So the question that I ask is water slippery or is it sticky? Is it slippery or sticky? Okay, well, I hear some right answers. But what happens if you're walking on the floor and there's some water there and you step on it, what could happen? Yeah, you could slip. So it's a little confusing. So I want to make sure everybody understands that water is sticky. Water is sticky. So how are we going to prove, we call that surface tension. As a matter of fact, there are some animals that can even walk right on the surface of water because the water molecules stick together. Does anybody see an animal walk right on water? Like insects do it all the time, like water spiders. They don't go kaplunk because they're not heavy enough. We go kaplunk because we're heavy enough to push the water molecules aside. So let's see if we can demonstrate surface tension. Here I have a couple transparencies, okay, and I'm going to duplicate experiment that you could do in your kitchen, right? You could take two plates or two saucers if they're exactly the same. You put them together and you just hold on to the top one. What happens to the bottom one? It just falls on the floor and breaks, right? Okay, so that's without any water. It's dry. What happens if we put some glue on this? Then they're going to stick together. If I just hold one, then the second one won't fall down, right? So what could we use as glue that we have in the room? We got water right here. At least I hope nobody turned the water off. All right, so I'm going to, fantastic, got some water. And do you think this is any kind of special water? I'm not tricking you, okay? Just regular municipal water that we have. All right, I'm just going to squeegee it off just a little bit to make sure that it doesn't drip on somebody, okay? And now I'm going to hold one sheet and let go of the other, and what's going to happen to the other sheet? Is it going to fall like before? It's not. Why is that? Because water is acting like a glue because of surface tension. All right, now, is that a very strong force? Well, I need an assistant. I'm going to hold on to one sheet here. You're going to hold on to this other one, and I'm going to pull straight up. Okay? I'm going to pull straight up. You only got that one. I'm going to pull straight up, and was that a lot of force? Yeah, I lifted your arm up, even though you were holding it. All right, so surface tension is a very powerful force, and there is water inside the alveolus. Let's go back to these slides. So there is water all around the inside of this alveolus, and that surface tension would work so that the wall of the alveolus, they would all get stuck together and they would never inflate. So if the wall of all these alveoli gets stuck together, then you can't get air in the alveolus, you can't get gas exchange, and that would be a horrible thing. So surfactant is a compound that decreases surface tension, which allows these alveoli to expand. And I should bring some soap in next time. So a really good example of an artificial surfactant would be soap, for instance. And now you can see that would really be slippery, right? Soapy water is a lot more slippery than just regular water. You could try that at home as well. Okay, so that's the importance of surfactant. And there are some cells responsible for secreting that surfactant, and that's a alveolar type 2 cell. Alveolar type 2 secretes surfactant. There's also an alveolar type 1, and that's just the cell that makes up the rest of the wall of the alveolus. So type 1 makes the wall, type 2 makes surfactant, which allows, what does that allow? Okay, type 2 makes a chemical that allows for expansion of the alveoli or inflation of the alveoli. You could think of it either way. And then there are some immune cells like macrophages, which were monocytes that crawled out of the vascular system because these are shape-shifting cells, right? So they can squeeze between little spaces between cells to get out of a blood vessel into these spaces, always looking for stuff that doesn't belong there. All right. Well, what's missing on this particular slide? I see capillaries. I see the wall. But what else did we mention so far that surrounds every alveolus? Those elastic fibers, right? Here are these elastic fibers, right? So that when we expand an alveolus, right, when we relax the tension on that alveolus, it goes back to its original shape. So here I got a couple things. I've got a paper bag and I have a balloon. And I'm going to ask you which one is a better model of an alveolus, because I'm going to inflate these with air, just like an alveolus, and then you got to tell me which one is which. I got this one on the way home last night for Thursday. All right, so I'm going to, so it's nice and contracted. And how do we inflate it? Well, I'm just going to blow some air in there, like so. Did it inflate? Did you see it inflate, get bigger? Okay. I don't know where that sound came from. But anyway, it's inflated, right? And what's going to happen to the shape of this paper bag when I let go of the top of it, when I open up the top of the bag? What happens to all that air inside the bag? Is it going to go out? Is it going to rush out? Okay, let's do it. So I'm going to make sure that the trachea is open, right? And it's nice and open. I can see right inside the bag, and you notice that it didn't change shape. So the air inside the bag just stayed there. So that's one kind of alveolus. Here is another kind. All right, you got to decide which one is better, paper bag or balloon. This is an old balloon. I hope it doesn't blow up. Okay, so I'm going to put air in here too. Oh, good. It didn't blow up. Sometimes they rip when I do that. Oh, sorry. All right. So now I have occluded the opening to the balloon so air can't rush out. And then I'm just going to let go. What's going to happen to that air inside the balloon? Is it going to stay inside the balloon? No. Wow, it went over there, right? What did it do to that air? It forced it out in a hurry. All right, so what's a better model of an alveolus, the rubber balloon or the paper bag? Paper bag? Okay, who votes for paper bag? Nobody. Okay, forget the paper bag. But, oh, we got to do the other experiment. Who votes for balloon? All right, almost everybody votes for balloon. Not everybody, but almost everybody did. Some people, right, opted out. All right, it is the balloon because that balloon is acting like these elastic fibers. All right, so we need for regular breathing, we need some muscles to inhale. But the breathing that you're doing right now, we call that quiet breathing. That muscle relaxes, and then air leaves your lungs passively because of this elastic tissue around the lung forces the air out. So in the type of breathing, we call that quiet breathing that you're doing right now. Inspiration is active, and you probably know what muscle is necessary for that. Does anybody know what muscle that is? That is the diaphragm. That has to contract, so that requires energy. And that inflates your lungs, but to exhale, all you have to do is relax the diaphragm and you automatically exhale because of these elastic fibers or these elastic fibers that you have. Okay. All right, so that's a pretty good experiment to do. And the pleural cavities. So what kind of cavity are the lungs in? Let's see. There are basically two kinds of cavities. There are cavities that are open to the outside world, and they're covered with what kind of membrane? Cavities that are open to the outside world? A mucous membrane, and mucous membranes are not too complicated. Some of them do produce mucus, so sometimes it's not just one kind of cell that makes up that membrane. Sometimes there's two cells. What kind of cell makes mucus? Goblet cell, right? So there's regular epithelial cells and goblet cells. So that's a little complicated. But the other kind of cavity is a cavity that's inside your body that's not open to the outside world. And that's a serous cavity, right? And you have visceral organs inside those serous cavities. And the membrane is not a mucous membrane. It's a bit more complicated than a mucous membrane. It's not just one layer. It is what kind of membrane? This is all review for you guys. It is a serous membrane. And how many divisions does a serous membrane have? I heard three. At least I think I heard three. I'm almost positive I heard three. I want to hear three because that is the correct answer. And let me see if I have a slide that kind of shows that. Maybe this one right here. Indeed it is. So let's look at this particular piece. So this is a nice, what kind of section is this? Nice transverse section. I can see some myocardium. I can see some lungs. And I can see some blood vessels. Oh, let's look at these blood vessels. Name this blood vessel right here. This one right here. It's in the lung, so it's pulmonary, right? But is it an artery or a vein? Okay. It's blue. I'm trying to trick you. It is an artery, right? Because it has deoxygenated blood. This blood is moving away from the heart. So here's the pulmonary trunk, here's the right ventricle. Blood is moving into this away from the heart to the lungs. And it is relatively low in oxygen, so it's colored blue. But what's the function of a lung? It is to get rid of CO2 and absorb oxygen, right? And it happens in these capillaries that you saw around all those alveoli. So that blood then picks up oxygen and then it becomes this red color. So I see some red blood vessels and this blood is returning to the heart. So here's a red blood vessel returning blood to the heart. Tell me what kind of blood vessel this is. It's a pulmonary, or name the vessel, it's pulmonary vein, right? So the colors are opposite compared to the systemic circulation. All right, so I've mentioned that a number of times. You just got to be comfortable. Got to be comfortable with knowing that, okay? Because You can also then think of the fetal circulation the same way, right? The umbilical artery is relatively low. The umbilical vein is relatively high in oxygen. Because what is the umbilical arteries and veins go to the placenta, and what's the job of the placenta? They're acting like the lungs. They're acting like the lungs for the fetus, right? So their circulatory system should actually correspond very nicely with the pulmonary circulation in us, but not the, it shouldn't correspond with, what is the second circulation? Systemic circulation, right? Fetal circulation is a lot different than the systemic circulation in an adult. Okay, oh, we were talking about the membrane. Okay, so here are the lungs inside the thoracic cavity. So here's the wall of the thoracic cavity. Here is the surface of the lungs. And so there's got to be a membrane that lines this cavity, right? That lines the thoracic cavity. And what kind of membrane was that once again? A serous membrane. And a serous membrane has three parts to it. There's a part that is on the wall of that particular cavity. There is a space with fluid in it. And then there is a membrane that's on the surface of the visceral organ, in this case, the lungs. So how are we going to name these things? They are continuous, right? It's really one membrane that just kind of wraps around, but they're in two different locations, so they have two different names. The one that's on the visceral organ is what we call the visceral serous membrane. The one that lines the cavity is called the parietal serous membrane. Maybe is that labeled on here? Am I right? Pleural cavity, someplace. Top left over here someplace. Ah, parietal pleura. Okay, and that's a serous membrane, but pleura is specific just to the compartment that the lungs are in. All right, so here is the parietal pleura, here's the visceral pleura, and then you have the pleural cavity in between. All right, so the way we breathe is by changing the shape of our thoracic cavity, by increasing and decreasing, and then the lungs kind of go with it. So the lungs should actually be glued to the wall of the thorax. So do you think it would be a good idea to have surfactant in this pleural cavity? Or should it just be water? If you want these things to stick together, which one should it be? Surfactant or just plain water? You know what? I think I see some people say just plain water. Right? So there is not surfactant in the pleural cavity because then the surface of the lung would slip away from the wall of the thorax. And when that happens, the lungs would not inflate. Right? So we need surfactant on the inside of the lung, but not surfactant on the outside. We need to have the stickiness. We need that surface tension of water to make sure that the lungs inflate. All right, so that's something about all those membranes. Sometimes you can get an inflammation of that space. That's called, does anybody know what that's called when you get an inflammation? Okay, between the visceral and parietal membranes of the pleura. It's called pleurisy, right? Pleurisy. And pleurisy is really painful. Guess when it's the most painful? Yeah, when you breathe, right? When you inhale, right? It feels like somebody's stabbing you in the chest with a knife, which is really, really uncomfortable, right? And you probably run into some patients with that, right? And so what would you like to do if every time you take a breath, it feels like somebody's stabbing you in the chest? Not just in one spot, but pretty much all over the place. You'd like to not breathe. You'd like to hold your breath, okay? But if you hold your breath for long enough, what does that feel like? Is that comfortable? No, that's very uncomfortable too. So what's worse, getting stabbed in the chest or getting this feeling that you're about ready to pass out and die? Well, neither of those. That's not a good option, right? It's a terrible option. So when you're presented with this terrible option, pain no matter what you do we do for patients that are experiencing that? This is a really good example of proper treatment. You give them opiates, right? You give them pain medication. And that helps them breathe, and of course, they'll thank you for that because it's really nice to be able to breathe without having that feeling of being stabbed in the chest. But then you also got to fight that infection that's in there as well. But first, good pain medication. Okay, so how do these lungs inflate and deflate? Well, there is just a little bit of math that I want you to know. Right? We're going to look at when they inflate, the lungs get bigger, the volume gets larger, and there are also pressure changes that take place. And so let's think about those pressure changes for a second. How does a molecule move by diffusion? How does a molecule move? From high concentration to low. There's got to be a concentration gradient, right? It'll move from high to low. And what happens to diffusion if the concentrations become equal? Diffusion stops, right? All right, so what is the force that moves air? Air is a fluid, so a gas is a fluid, a liquid is a fluid. How do these fluids move from one area to another in our body? It's not by concentration gradient, but it's by a pressure gradient. So you can almost think of pressure as being concentration of a molecule, but here is a really good analogy. You said diffusion goes from high to low. What about flow of a fluid? How does it go, from low to high or high to low? Okay, it goes from high to low as well, just like diffusion, right? So in order for air to move in the lungs, right, the pressure has to be reduced compared to atmospheric pressure. Then the air has high pressure, low pressure in the lungs, air will flow in. How is that controlled? It's controlled with this little relationship, right? The volume of a container, right, if we don't allow anything to move in or out of it, we just have a stationary container, is going to be equal to something, right? It's going to be equal to, okay, 1 over the pressure. 1 over pressure. So there's a nice relationship right there. I think that's called Boyle's Law, right? And how would we describe this relationship? You know, like for sympathetic, parasympathetic, it's antagonistic. But how would we, okay, we could say B equals A. That's another mathematical equation that doesn't go with this particular discussion. But how would we describe the relationship of A and B? These are two different things. But what's the relationship? They are directly related. If B increases, what happens to A? It increases automatically. If A increases, what happens to B? B increases, right? That's directly related. Directly related. Now, what about this one over here? You got P in the denominator. Is this directly related? It is not directly related, because that's it over here. This is what we call inversely related. So pressure and volume are inversely related to each other. And what does that always mean? It always means this. If it's directly related, if one goes up, the other goes up, that's always the case. Over here, inversely related, it's always the case that if volume goes up, okay, what happens to the other side of this equation? It goes down, right? So if volume increases, right, then... Do I have that right? Yeah, that's same. Right, it goes down. Volume increases, pressure goes down. This whole quantity over here, that's inversely related. So this is how our body changes pressure inside our lungs, is by changing the volume of our thoracic cavity. Right? So let's increase the volume of our thoracic cavity. What happens to the pressure inside the thoracic cavity if we increase the volume? Yeah, it goes down. All right, so I'm going to increase the volume of my thoracic cavity by expanding my rib cage. What did that do to pressure inside my lungs? That decreased it because it's inversely related. Stayed the same in the air, so air went from high pressure to low pressure because the size of my thorax, right, increased. Now, how can I exhale? I need to get the pressure higher inside my thoracic cavity. I can contract some muscles like abdominal muscles, and the internal intercostals will decrease the volume of my thorax. What happens to the pressure then of my thorax when I decrease volume? It increases, it gets higher than atmospheric pressure, so it goes from my lungs into the air because it goes from high pressure to low pressure. Right? So I want you to know that there are volume changes. And here is another little experiment. So this is somebody's thoracic cage, and this black thing represents the diaphragm. when the diaphragm is relaxed, it's shaped like a dome. All right, so I'm going to push in on the diaphragm because then it will look like a dome. Right? All right, and so that's going to change the volume of this container. The size of the container can't change shape because it's hard plastic. But the volume can change because I can pull the diaphragm out, making the volume here bigger. All right, what are those balloons represent? Your lungs. Yeah, you got two of them. All right, and so that's inside the chamber, but it also has a trachea because those balloons are open to the outside world, the outside air. All right, so how can we change the pressure inside this glass jar? Let's say we want to decrease the pressure. We want to decrease the pressure. What do we have to do to the volume? Increase it. How can we increase it? By pulling on the diaphragm. That's what happens to the diaphragm when it contracts. And if that's the case, the pressure inside the jar decreases, the pressure in the air stays the same, the balloons are connected to the pressure in the air, what do you think should happen to the balloons? They should inflate, right? Because the pressure in the air is greater than inside this jar, and let's try to do that experiment. So I'm going to hold the jar, I'm going to contract the diaphragm, and look what happened. What happened? The lungs inflated. And what happens if we relax the diaphragm? It goes back to that dome. And what happens to the balloons? They shrink down. All right. And this is almost a good example of your lungs, but I'm not really activating any elastic properties. Right? I'm not inflating the balloons enough to do that. That's just with volume changes of the thorax. Right? We could get this little thing here to breathe for us. All right, so let's look at the mechanics of breathing a little bit. All right, so inspiration is due to enlargement of the thoracic cavity. Right? Enlargement of the thoracic cavity. And in quiet breathing, the only muscle that's really working is the diaphragm, just like our experiment right here. Right? Depressing the diaphragm, that enlarges the thoracic cavity, decreasing the pressure, air flows in. All right, another kind of breathing is what we call forced breathing. And forced breathing is when you're hyperventilating, like when you're exercising. That's a different kind of breathing. You have to move more air in and out of your lungs more quickly. And then some additional muscles have to be used to do that. The diaphragm is just not enough. So the pectoralis minor, the external intercostals. Remember, external for inspiration. It doesn't quite match up. External for inspiration. Sternocleidomastoid helps because it helps elevate the rib cage, serratus anterior, elevates the sternum and the ribs, and this will all expand the volume of the lungs, decreasing the pressure. Right, so this is forced breathing. Let's think of inspiration. How does air get out? Quiet breathing. Right, I have passive here. What does that mean? No muscle contraction. Muscles just relax, and then the elastic fibers around each alveolus cause the alveoli to shrink back down, and that forces air out of the lungs. So quiet breathing is completely passive. All right, expiration is due to those elastic fibers surrounding each alveolus causing the alveoli to constrict. All right, so the volume of an alveolus constricts, that increases the pressure, that forces air out of the lung. All right, what about for forced breathing? For expiration. Forced breathing, we need some muscles for expiration, like the rectus abdominis. What does that rectus abdominis do? And actually all the abdominal muscles. When they contract, it compresses your abdomen and it forces abdominal organs up into the thoracic cage, right? Decreasing the volume of the thorax. It helps push on the diaphragm. All right, so that's what the abdominal muscles do, plus the internal intercostals. Right, we'll depress the rib cage, that decreases the volume, and those are important muscles. Those muscles require energy, so we say that is active. Right, so forced expiration is active, right, but what about just relaxed expiration? It is passive just due to those elastic fibers. All right, so that's something that's pretty important to know. We talked about this. I'll talk about control in just a little bit. All right, what do we have in terms of pictures here? Okay, I got a picture of a lung, then a transverse section of a lung. All right. And so for inspiration, what has to happen to the volume of the thorax for inspiration? Does it have to get bigger or smaller? Bigger, right? And so how does that happen? Well, we have these intercostal muscles that elevate the rib cage, but when that happens, that also moves the rib cage anteriorly. When the external intercostals contract, it moves the rib cage laterally. So both anterior and laterally, right? That increases the volume of the thorax. Okay. On expiration, right, you have contraction of the internal intercostals, abdominal muscles pushing up on the diaphragm, right, and that's going to change the volume. It's going to shrink the volume of the thorax. That is going to increase the pressure that forces air out. So that's the importance of those muscles. Mechanics of breathing. All right, let's talk about the control of respiration. Okay, control of respiration. Do you breathe without thinking about it? Do you breathe involuntarily, like when you're sleeping? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so, and the most important muscle for inspiration is the diaphragm. So is the diaphragm a skeletal muscle or a smooth muscle? Is it voluntary or involuntary? Yeah, because we don't have to think about it when we're asleep, right? So it's kind of like involuntary muscle there. But what can you do? You can hold your breath, right? And you can inhale forcefully. You can exhale forcefully. So the diaphragm is under voluntary control. You can take control of it with your thoughts. So it is really, what kind of muscle? Skeletal or smooth? It is skeletal muscle because it's under your voluntary control. But then when you stop thinking about it, there are other things in your brain that can take over. Right? So that's kind of an interesting thing. The diaphragm is sort of like a combination of smooth muscle and skeletal muscle because you can control it, but it can also contract by itself depending on what the conditions are inside your body, whether you need oxygen or not. Okay, and that control center, right, the control center is in the medulla, and you know where that is. Right, so here is the cerebral hemispheres, here's the pons, and down here is the spinal cord. So what do we got in this region right here? That's part of the central nervous, that's the medulla oblongata. Right, that controls inspiration and expiration because there's a respiratory center there. It controls the rate and depth of respiration. There are three important areas, three nuclei. Right, the respiratory group, and that's the pacemaker that just automatically can excite the diaphragm to contract, just like, what's the pacemaker in your heart? Yeah, the SA node. So various locations in your body, you do have pacemakers, right, including in the medulla. That's the basic rate for inspiration. You have a dorsal respiratory group and a pontine respiratory center. So the dorsal respiratory group right here is what actually sends the signals to the diaphragm to contract. This ventral respiratory group, right, will excite the dorsal respiratory group to cause contraction. But there's some antagonistic control. The pontine respiratory center can inhibit the ventral respiratory center. Therefore, right, the dorsal respiratory group will slow down the contraction of the diaphragm and will slow down the rate of inspiration. All right, so it's not nice and simple like parasympathetic and sympathetic, but there's something that drives respiration, right, and that drive center can be inhibited, right, and the drive center has control over the sending of impulses to the diaphragm. So what kind of nerve, what do these nerves look like here? These are cranial nerves, right? They're not spinal nerves because they're coming from the cranium. And there is also another nerve going to that most important muscle for inspiration, which is the diaphragm. And does anybody remember that name of the nerve that goes to the diaphragm? It's not a cranial nerve. It's a spinal nerve. comes from the cranial plexus. It is the phrenic nerve. Yes, the phrenic nerve, and it has to go through the cervical plexus. And the plexus gets innervation from what levels of the spinal cord? Where is the origin? What participates in forming that phrenic nerve? And the little saying is, C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. What does C stand for? Cervical region, right? So those are the three origins of the phrenic nerve, goes through the cervical plexus and then all the way down to the diaphragm. And I'm sure you agree with me that the diaphragm is the most important muscle for inspiration. And without the phrenic nerve, right, you can't inhale, which is a terrible thing. Then something has to breathe for you when that happens. Okay, well, the rate and depth of respiration is controlled by the amount of oxygen that you have in your body, and you have receptors in this blood vessel. What blood vessel is this? The aorta. The arch of the aorta has receptors, right? So it's measuring the chemical concentration of your blood. That sends the information to the medulla, where the respiratory centers are. That will help automatically adjust the rate of inspiration. Like, for instance, if you hold your breath, oxygen concentration goes down, CO2 goes up, and what do you feel consciously? Does that bother you? Do you have any idea that you're holding your breath? Yeah, right? You become uncomfortable and you get the urgency to, what do you get the urgency to do? Inhale when that happens, right? So these receptors here are telling your brain a lot about the state of blood. Right? There's another area that's really important. All right, so what do we call this first branch off the aorta? Brachiocephalic, and then it branches, the brachiocephalic branches into, what's this one here? Okay, close, it's close to the vertebral, but the vertebrals come from this one. Right, brachiocephalic branches into the, okay, let's try this one. What's this one over here? That's the common carotid. Right, here's the common carotid taking blood to the head. So brachiocephalic branches into the common carotid and the one that goes to your arm. Right, that's the brachial part. That's the, and it goes right underneath the clavicle. That's a hint. That is the subclavian artery. Right, so brachiocephalic branches into subclavian and common carotid. And the reason why I'm talking about this, not because I'm really interested in the subclavian, but as the common carotid courses up to your brain, okay, in your neck, what does it do? It bifurcates. It branches into two blood vessels. And you should know the names of these two blood vessels. Okay? Yeah, you have an internal and external carotid artery. Right? The internal goes to your brain. The external goes to places outside the cranial bones. But this is the thing that I really want you to know. This is where I'm going. Look at this area right here. I mentioned this before when we were in the vascular chapter. This has got a very special name where this bifurcation takes place. Anybody remember what that is? Okay. And it's important because, look, it has receptors just like the arch of the aorta. Right? This is called the carotid sinus. Remember that carotid sinus. So aortic arch, carotid sinus have chemoreceptors for monitoring chemicals in your blood like oxygen and CO2. In these two areas, they also contain pressure receptors, baroreceptors. All right, so these are two really important areas. That's why I mentioned the, what is this area right here? The sinus, the carotid sinus. And this is probably the most frequently imaged area in the human body. Right? People are probably lined up on the sidewalk outside the hospital waiting for an ultrasound of just this area because it produces a lot of pathology. Right? It can rip, it can form blood clots. And when it starts to occlude, then blood doesn't go to your brain. And when you don't have blood going to your brain, what happens? Well, of course, you would get very loopy, right? You would forget where you are, who you're with, right? Stop for stoplights, that kind of stuff. Your brain just won't function. And we would like to know if this carotid sinus is healthy, right? And if it's healthy, then that's not what's causing that lack of consciousness. And that happens a lot in people. And ultrasound is a good modality for looking at the carotid sinus. Okay. So outputs to the diaphragm, we said the phrenic nerve, right? phrenic nerve. You guys right here, I asked you this, right? The origin is what, C3, 4, and 5? Remember, C3 and 4 keeps you what? Keeps you alive. Yes. Okay, inputs to the respiratory center. Where's the respiratory center located so that you don't have to think about every breath you take? Where's that respiratory center located? In the medulla. There's also a little bit in the pons. I don't know if I say that in here. Your book doesn't make a big deal of it. But, I do say medulla and pons. All right, so there are even receptors in the medulla and pons for CO2 and for pH. I don't think we've ever talked about pH in here, but some of you might know. What does pH really mean? It's a measure of what? Acidity. It's a measure of acidity in a solution. Right? And so you can measure the pH and you can figure out what the acidity is. The strange thing about this pH number is that it's inversely related to the acid that's inside your body. What does that mean if it's inversely related? If pH goes up, okay, what happens to the acidity? Goes down. If the pH number goes up, the acidity of your body goes down. If the acidity of your body goes down, what happens to the pH number? It gets bigger, right? So that's something strange, but you get used to that really soon. All right, so what can stimulate ventilation with these central receptors? And when we say a central receptor, what do we mean? Central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? Central nervous system, that's what we mean. It's a pretty simple concept, but if you don't link it up, you might get confused. So central receptors are in the central nervous system someplace. All right, and they can monitor CO2 and pH. When pH decreases, what happens to your body? Become more acidic or less acidic? Yeah, remember, it's inversely related. When pH goes down, your body becomes more acidic. That increases ventilation. Right? If CO2 increases, right? CO2 is directly related to ventilation. If CO2 increases, ventilation increases. And there's a very important link between CO2 and acidity in your body. And you got to take the next course. You got to take a physiology course to see what that connection is. Okay. So you have central receptors that can monitor CO2 and the acidity. You have peripheral receptors, right? They respond only to large changes in oxygen. Where are those peripheral receptors at? Not in the brain, but in the arch of the aorta and the carotid sinus. That's where those receptors are. And they will be a very powerful motivator. Oh, it says right here, carotid sinus, arch of the aorta, right? Right? When oxygen decreases by what, a little or a lot? A lot. I see a whole bunch of arrows there. Oxygen concentration has to decrease by a lot, but that will be a very powerful stimulus for ventilation. So for instance, we could all let's do an experiment. Let's do one more experiment today in class, okay? What will happen at the end of this experiment? We're all going to hold our breath, okay, and oxygen is going to decrease, right, in our body, and we're going to have an urgency to breathe, but let's not. Let's keep holding our breath. Let's keep holding our breath until we pass out, okay? You're laughing, but we should do this. What's going to happen as soon as you pass out? You start breathing again because why? These peripheral receptors are saying, wow, the oxygen concentration in your body is drop tremendously, we better start breathing, and you're going to start gasping and breathing when that happens, all right? So, and that happens because of the peripheral receptors. You guys didn't seem real interested about doing that experiment. You don't want to pass out? Okay, maybe over the weekend, holiday weekend, you can try that. Okay, so so you won't have an urgency to breathe, right, until this oxygen concentration is so low that you pass out. Right? And as a matter of fact, some kids do that when they want to freak their parents out, right? They hold their breath when they're having a temper tantrum and then they pass out trying to really freak their parents. Oh, I see some people laughing out there. So you probably did this when you were a kid, huh? No? Okay. Well, I'm sure somebody did in here. All right. So actually, this is actually fatal for a group of people that are sport divers. They call them free divers, people that go down underneath the surface of the water without a scuba tank, without carrying their own air with them. They just hold their breath, right, to go to, and they can swim down to by themselves, 30 feet easy, Right? I don't know what the record is. The record is hundreds of feet, but then they have to take an apparatus to go down. But let's just say 30 feet, and they want to stay down as long as they can because they're hunting for fish. Right? So how do they prepare themselves to go underneath the water? Well, what they do is that they first hyperventilate. So they breathe very fast for a long period of time, right? And when you breathe fast, you get rid of CO2 from your body. The oxygen concentration really doesn't go up. It's already maximally carrying the amount of oxygen that it can. But if you hyperventilate, you get rid of CO2 so that it takes a longer time to build up, right? Remember, when CO2 increases, you get the urgency to breathe. But if somebody hyperventilates, what happens to that urgency to breathe when you hyperventilate and get rid of all that CO2? That urgency to breathe goes away, right? Because that CO2 has gone away. So you can hold your breath for a longer period of time under the water. But now, what about oxygen? Is your body still using up oxygen? Well, you're kicking to stay down underneath the water. You're using muscle. So yeah, your body is using a tremendous amount of oxygen to make all that ATP, to power all those muscles, right? So you dove down to 60 feet below the surface, but you hyperventilated first, which means you don't have an urgency to breathe, but your body uses up all the oxygen. What happens to you? Just like if we were to do that experiment in class. Well, we should really do that experiment. What's going to happen to you if we hold our breath long enough? We're going to pass out. And then what happens? You're going to start breathing again, but what about this diver? He starts breathing where? Like 60 feet under the surface of the water. That's not good, right? So that's kind of like a fatal experiment to do. Don't do that one at home, right? So these free divers have to be very careful, right? Because they can get rid of a lot of CO2, but they don't notice that they're running out of oxygen until they pass out, right? And then they drown. So you got to be really aware of that. All right, so that's just a little bit of discussion about CO2 and oxygen. What else can regulate respiration? Higher centers, like the cerebral cortex, because the diaphragm is under what kind of control? Voluntary control of skeletal muscles. So again, we could all hold our breath in here if we wanted to by not letting the diaphragm contract, right? We could keep that diaphragm relaxed. But also emotional stimulus. Like what would produce an emotional stimulus? I don't know. Maybe if I take an ice cube and put it on the back of your neck, that might be emotional stimulus. That will increase ventilation, right? If I did that, would you just kind of breathe normally? You would probably do what? You'd probably go, right? So the higher centers, like the hypothalamus, will regulate ventilation. Proprioceptors, we talked about them. Maybe I didn't tell you exactly what they are, but muscle spindle apparatus, Golgi tendon organs are part of proprioceptors. They monitor the activity in muscles and joints, and when muscles start to contract and joints start to bend, these proprioceptors send information to the medulla saying that you need more oxygen in your body, right? So just by moving these muscles and joints, what do you have? You have an urgency to breathe. Right, so you could actually do this experiment right now because you won't pass out if you do it. So right now you could move your arms around and your legs stay seated, right? Move your arms and legs around and you're not really exercising, right? I mean, if you were to stand up and run down the stairs and use those same muscles or lift weights with your arms, then that would really be exercise. So right now you're just angulating joints, stretching some muscles, but you're not really doing any work. That is still enough of a stimulus to cause you to have an urgency to breathe, right? Okay. Other receptors. Oh, touch, pain, and temperature. Oh, I talked about this one already. Touch. Yeah, if you get poked in the side, probably you would go, right? Call that a gasp reflex. Any kind of pain. And temperature. Oh, like that ice cube causes a gasp reflex, right? Of very sudden inhalation. And that's kind of almost uncontrolled. You can't override it in your brain, right? Because the diaphragm is skeletal muscle. But you have to know that it's happening before it happens. And I can think of a situation, I was just amazed that nobody died. It happened maybe about 10 years ago. Have you ever heard of these hornblower yachts, hornblower company? They have boats in Newport Harbor and Marina Del Rey, and it's a big boat, and so people can rent this big boat and have a party on it. So it's big enough to have a party, and you can have a band and a bar and everything, right? And this one yacht in Marina Del Rey, their company was having a Christmas party. And it was maybe Christmas Eve, so everybody was all dressed up in fancy dresses and maybe tuxedos. And they were on this hornblower yacht in Marina Del Rey, kind of motoring around the harbor. And all of a sudden, it caught on fire, the engine caught on fire, and the boat got stuck in the middle of the harbor. So people just couldn't just walk from the boat onto the pier where they would be safe. And the boat was on fire, maybe almost sinking, and the boat didn't have any life rafts. So you might be wondering, duh, why not have any life rafts on a boat that's on the ocean, right? Well, that's because it was just going around the harbor. But they had to have life preservers, right? So people got life preservers, right? So it's middle of the night, pitch black outside. You have to jump off the boat with your fancy dress, maybe tuxedo, right? So it's not anything that you would normally do, right? I hope. And people would jump into the ocean, and I was just really amazed. Nobody died, because when you hit that cold water, what's going to happen to you? It's going to produce this gasp reflex, and if your head is underwater, like when you jump off of a big boat, what's going to happen? Again, you're going to inhale all that water, and that's going to lead to drowning. So these people with the fancy dresses jumped in. I'm sure they went when they hit the water, and they didn't die because why? Probably because they were wearing life preservers that kept their head above water. Or maybe they were instructed by the crew, right, not to breathe in until they came back up to the surface. But I would doubt that the crew really knew much about this gasp reflex. Right? But now you do, and you could tell your kids about that. Make sure you hold your breath when you jump into cold water. Okay. So there are other things that can regulate ventilation, right, the higher centers. Anybody have any questions about the respiratory system, anatomy of respiratory system, maybe some of the physiology of it? You're good. Sign-in sheet is going around someplace. Who's got the sign-in sheet? Go ahead, raise it up. Good. You'll bring it down. Good, you'll bring it down. Thanks. And we will see you next Monday. Do you have a test next Monday? Ah, you're probably hyperventilating, emotional stimulus, right? No, you do not have an exam on Monday. It's what? Exactly 2 weeks from today.